Ready. Okay, cool. We're ready to go. I am here at the spot. It's Billy. It is day three of Eternal Weekend. I am not nearly as tired as I was before. I'm very sorry about those first two episodes. I was just fucked up tired. Traveling, late events, but we're back. We actually got the recording rig set up a little bit better this time. And welcome to the EW Dress Crew Crib. I'm here with Rob, and he is laying out... What is this? Are these your picks for the day?
Yeah, I just got a bunch of signatures and...
Sigs?
Yeah, Sigs, and I picked up some Tormod's Crypt. Also, you don't look tired. You look bounding. You look well-rested.
It's because we just got some Thai food. Nikki's Thai Kitchen.
Nikki's Thai Kitchen. Some heaping portions.
Heaping.
And they absolutely delicious. And I didn't risk the Massaman curry, even though that's an all-time favorite. It's hit and miss with some spots. I figured, like you said, pad thai is a tried and proven favorite.
Yeah,
chicken pad thai, where it's at.
Yeah, it's like you go to an American diner, you know, two fried eggs, toast, home fries, a meat of your choice, coffee, water, juice, and like you expect them to nail it.
Yep.
Same thing, Thai Kitchen. If they can't nail their pad thai,
they don't deserve the name.
Exactly.
You know.
So what are we looking at? You got your Sigs here.
Yeah, so I got a few Enlightened Tutor and a Mox Diamond. Mr. Dan Frazier, who is surprisingly curmudgeonly and not very self-aware, but that's okay because he's been in the game a long time. He's tired. He deserves some respect. Yeah. And I got some... What do I have? I got my Foil and Nulls signed.
Sick.
And what else do I have here? I got to meet Kaya and Phil Foglio.
What are they like? Because they're like... Their art style is so distinctive.
Yes.
I don't fuck with artists that much. I just know like the bigs, like Ron Spencer, RK Post, and like Heather.
Heather Hudson.
Heather Hudson, Rebecca Guay, and then after that, I don't really mess with. I'm just not an artist guy.
I would say that Drew Tucker is one of them. Yeah,
yes,
like one of the most criminally underrated artists in Magic history.
Super dark, smudgy style.
Yeah, it was very impressionistic.
Like cave troll type
cave
stuff.
Cave dweller, or murk dwellers, I think.
Yeah.
But then again, like, I'm an art school dropout, so like that style.
Yeah.
I love stuff like that.
Yeah.
So
the Folios.
Yeah, they are sweet as pie. I thought that Kaya was super accommodating and like very sweet to talk to. Phil, he's got that kind of like, I don't know, I don't want to say guarded. He's just like kind of a sober personality, but like he's kind enough and, you know, does what you they say. Hey, would you sign it here? Sure. Whatever you need. And what color do you want? Oh, dealer's choice. And he plays nicely.
Sure.
And those two still get along really well. It's really nice to see. And Heather Hudson actually, at LobsterCon, just this year, we had a conversation about them and how, you know, Miss Hudson got her start in magic art. And she's like, oh, I was just in the right place at the right time, just doing art over at Kaya and Phil's. I'm like, you're just...
So she's
name
an old homie of theirs.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
That's cool.
So it's
the
not...
The lore.
It's not who you are. It's who you know. But you know what? I think the magic community is better for that, you know? Like, that they had that connection and they brought her in. It's just so cool. It's so sick.
So let's see what you got here. I see some portents.
Yeah, I would say that Liz Danforth is probably my favorite artist that I've ever met in person in terms of like her warmth and her personality and her like her vulnerability and her storytelling.
Yeah.
She has so much lore and she doesn't gatekeep. She's not like too cool for school. She tells you every detail about everything she puts in her art.
That's great.
And there's always a personal connection. Oh, this represents a friend of mine, and this represents this time in my life when I was, you know, when this person was close to me. And I was like, wow, I could just sit there and listen to her all day. You know, even when I first met her today, you know, for the first time. In fact, I brought some portents up. I said, would you mind just, you know, putting your Herbie Hancock on there or whatever.
Yeah.
And then we just naturally fell into a conversation about, you know, what she loves to do. She's like, yeah, I love being here. She's like, you know, having you here smiling at me. Cause I told her, I'm like, you know, I consider you really important. And I think, you know, having access to the people that made the game like very special in a visual sense means a lot to me. And she went on to say, yeah, this is all I do. She said, I just sit in my studio and just listen to audiobooks, and it's just me all by myself. And that, like,
yeah,
broke
yeah.
my heart a little bit. And so we segued into dogs because she's like, yeah, I just lost my dog and I don't want to get another dog because I don't want them to outlive me.
That's rough. Yeah.
And so I shared, you know, that I missed my dogs, and like, full disclosure, I'm standing there in the middle of this airplane hangar surrounded by hundreds of Magic players with Liz Danforth crying.
Yeah.
Like, she and I were just like, yeah. like a, so like a tear filled thing.
You had started telling this story. You showed her your dog tattoo.
That's right.
Yeah. yeah. And you, for the listeners, Rob has a very large dog tattoo across his right rib cage.
That's right.
And it's a deceased dog.
That's right. That's, yeah. That's one of my OG pups, you know, very territorial and protective of me and my brother when we were kids. Mm-hmm. We lived in a really rough neighborhood.
Sure.
And we had people try to break in all the time.
Yeah.
And so they invariably left the property with more holes than they showed up with.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Good job, bud.
Good job, bud.
Yeah.
What's the late dog's name?
That's Bud.
Bud.
Yep.
Yeah. Bud. Yeah. Bud just punching holes.
Oh, he didn't give a fuck.
Hell yeah.
He was great.
Hell yeah.
Love that dog. And before him was another German Shepherd.
Yeah.
Mika.
Mika.
Yeah. Mika helped teach me how to walk.
That's amazing.
I would grab onto her fur, and like, she was so patient, such a sweet dog. And I still have very vivid memories, even, you know, at that young age about, you know, that old sweetheart. She was great. But anyway, Liz Danforth was very emotionally vulnerable and super accessible. And like, you know, we shared that moment in the middle of, you know, a billion people. But she made me feel like it was just me in the room.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
so that was really quite sweet.
That's
so
kind. That yeah. is kind.
She is a very kind person.
Our listeners are getting a very good taste for you, even though, like, you haven't had any airtime before on the podcast. And it's like, this is a very authentic Rob experience, listeners. Aww. Is that he's gentle is Aww. The word.
Well, thanks, pal. I appreciate it.
Nicole texted my girlfriend texted me. She goes, wait, have I met Rob? I'm like, maybe once in passing.
Yeah.
And he's like, he sounds very kind. I'm like, he is. He's very kind. Yeah.
I flatter myself that such is the case.
Yes.
You know, I think that kindness is sorely lacking, especially these days where everyone is so obsessed with being right. You know, we are beset on all sides by hot button issues and opinions, and like,
yeah.
you know, the internet, which allows people a platform and a voice, and they can't yeah. possibly be wrong. And people have a really hard time seeing things from perspectives other than their own. Right.
Yes. It is very, very difficult.
So kindness.
Yeah, literally my entire life.
Yeah. You get it.
Yeah.
And I know, you know.
Well, I don't get it.
Understood. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
I'm absolutely part of the problem.
Well, a lot of our listeners, I think, can relate to this point that, like, okay, when was the last time someone said, excuse me, or sorry, or I love you, or I miss you, or like held the door open for you?
Yeah.
You know, I think kindness is one of those kind of common threads that help weave us together as a species. Like, we're a cooperative species, right?
Sure, sure. We're a colony species.
Exactly. And so being cooperative has helped us proliferate and thrive. And I think now that we're so hermetic and self-righteous in some ways, the kindness is starting to evaporate. And it's shameful, but I think that we're seeing plenty of instances in real life now where people are trying to push against that almost inexorable tide of cruelty and opinion and so on and so forth, and just trying their best to be kind despite this tide.
That's one of the things I'm working on as a player, is that I want to win, and I want to win really, really, really badly.
Of course. Yeah.
And I also want, like, public recognition for winning, or if I can't win, if somebody wins with one of a deck that I, like, maybe did one tiny nudge towards developing the deck, like, it's really important to me that that's recognized.
Of course.
And it's, like, it's almost like the act of correcting somebody, even though I may be, like, for the record, I am factually right.
Yeah. Look, there's a difference between knowing you're right and being an arrogant prick, yeah.
Yeah, and that's absolutely, and it's like funny that I like felt compelled to even say that.
No, you know? I mean, it's honest.
Yeah, but
for sure.
This whole hobby is like, we're all like, it's a double consent thing about how to have fun. So I'm like eating like ass at this tournament. I'm like,
good for you, pal. Oh, wait, no, in a bad way.
In a bad
got
way.
It.
Yeah,
got
I'm
it,
not
got
I'm
it.
Not munching butt. I'm eating ass. And like a big like a succulent.
Yeah,
just a succulent Chinese meal.
Succulent Chinese meal. Yeah. Yes, dude.
Yeah, and I do not know my judo well. And I'm trying to. I'm actually sticking on the same deck because I want to learn about it. And it's not doing that great. I'm like maybe like 7 and 8
right
for the weekend. And I like I consider myself a good player. I have a ton of PM reps. Like,
yes.
Of the people in this room, anybody in Duress Crew is yeah. in the, just like just by rolling with us, you're in the top 10% for PM reps
sure.
in this building.
Sure.
So
here's a devil's advocate question.
Yeah.
Does the performance reflect on the deck that you're trying to develop, or could it be that you're just having an off couple days, or a natural variance, or you know other players are just super sharp right now, or they know how to answer this archetype, or you know, could be any of those things. Yeah,
there's a few things to it because there's what the deck is up to. There's the deck, so I'm playing Survival Terror again, and I'm just like really trying to tune some edges here and there.
Sure.
So there's the deck, there's the player, and then there's me, and then there's how I am reacting to my voice.
There we come to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
There we have yeah. it. So there's a really powerful analogy that Jess brought to me. Jess is my sweetie, and she said she showed me this thing, and it was like you are like adrift. You're in a boat, right?
Yep.
And people are like these empty boats that will just kind of roll up and bump into your boat.
Sure.
And you have the choice to get mad. Oh, this goddamn thing's bumping into this, that, and the third, and you know, and being curmudgeonly and snippety about it. But it's just an empty boat.
Yeah.
Right. And so ultimately, you are in control of your response to this empty boat bumping into it. It has no feelings about it. It doesn't mean anything by it. It's just yeah. an empty boat being carried by the tide, and it's just bumping into your hull. So I don't know exactly where I was going with that, but it seemed pertinent. You know,
yeah.
like, you know, if you're losing a game, all right, it's an empty boat. If
sure.
somebody doesn't say thank you, if you hold the door for them,
mm-hmm.
empty boat, whatever,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
you know? So
yeah.
I think having presence of mind and enough emotional control to zoom out, which I think is a critical skill, after being
yeah, yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
zoomed in on
yes.
the result, it helps you kind of appreciate the game for what it is, and that's ultimately a process.
Yes.
Right?
It's so interesting because I like, man, this is very funny. I have had, I think, so I'm playing this deck. It's very complicated.
Mm.
A lot of different lines. There are lines where I'm like, survivaling up a Sylvan Safety Keeper
yep.
so I can play it, so I can sacrifice a land to go down on a land with Sylvan Safety Keeper.
So that you can,
so
activate
my
Wayfarer yes.
to get a wasteland to take you off a color.
Correct. Yeah.
Or whatever.
Right, which is a deep line, and
it's
I think that's par
deep.
For the course for
and
that
then
deck.
I feel so clever, and then like they had like I took them off double blue, and then they had Mana Leak instead of Counterspell.
Right.
And I'm like, I was so much smarter than you. I was so much smarter than you. And then all you did was draw your 2 of Mana Leak instead of your 4 of Counterspell.
Yeah, exactly.
And like my card deserves to be in play by nature of how clever I am.
Empty boat.
It's an empty boat.
Dude, we call that entitlement tilt.
Yes. That is precisely what's going
yep,
on. Because
yep, yep.
I'm like, I play a lot. I
yeah.
have a good collection.
Sure.
I hang out with good players.
Right.
I play in New England. So I have this like massive entitlement thing.
Yes.
I deserve to win.
Right.
But,
but
like
someone's just going to top deck something sick and you're going to lose the game. And that's
but I don't. The thing is, it's like I don't deserve it. That's like the key.
Understood.
Word
so deserve. We don't get what we deserve. We get what we negotiate.
This is very interesting.
Yeah, for sure. I used to get that a lot when I used to play like 1-3 and 2-5. In No Limit Texas Hold'em, where I was like, I could calculate very deeply. I knew what I was supposed to do in what position in a 3-bet pot, or if it was like unopened, I knew the game theory optimal, right?
Yeah.
But I was also playing against people who had no understanding of the rules that I was playing by. So they're just like, oh, I have a K. That's cool. I'm going to put these chips in. And like, you're trying to, you almost like outplay yourself, right? You overlevel yourself and you're playing chess while they're playing checkers. And ultimately idiots are going to win sometimes.
Yep.
Right. But the two key words I think are over time. So like we put a huge emphasis on
recency bias.
Yes, exactly. So you realize that over the long term, if you zoom out, and there's zooming out again, right?
Yeah.
If you zoom out far enough, you realize that the spikes and valleys of that tiny data set that you're analyzing smooth out way further, and you realize that your trajectory is still positive, but sometimes you're just going to have to take a bad beat.
Sure.
And I think this is part and parcel of of what's going on in Magic.
Listeners, I was not expecting this to be as good of an episode. All right. We're pivoting. We're pivoting. This
okay.
is not how the crew's doing. This
All
is
right.
what Rob had. Yeah.
Yeah, tough shit.
Actually, we're about to pivot. I think we are going to pivot. I'm going to pause this podcast for a second.
All
Let's
right.
see if I can figure out how to actually put like the little interjection riff in here. If it doesn't show up, I don't care. I'm just going to pause for a second and we'll convene with the guys. We'll see what happens.
All
next.
Right.
Welcome back to Hardcast. Brendan here with Rob.
Hey.
And we just got back from dinner and I saw Rob playing chess.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Which is something that in college I actually started a chess club at my school and I left it in the past, shall we say, because as much as I liked it, it's a very frustrating game.
It's frustrating and it's brutal. It's unforgiving. And I think it rewards hard work. But, you know, it also punishes you in equal measure if, you know, you're lax. You know, you have to be super on all the time.
Yep.
Unless you're somebody like Mikhail Tal and you're just, whatever, it's a knight. I'll just fucking sack it in the center. And
yeah, dude, just sack everything.
Sack everything.
I love the when you look at games from, like, the 1800s and stuff. And it's just, like, just gambits left and right. And people just throwing pieces all over the place. It's so cool.
A lot of that was, like, that kind of machismo. Like, a lot of
right?
the dudes were very, a lot of bravado. And a lot of, like, I'm going to mate my opponent in seven. Like, they'll stand on a chair and announce to this crowd, you know, I intend to checkmate my opponent in no fewer than...
Twirl their mustache.
Seven moves. And everyone would be like, yay. You know?
Hit them with the mic long. You got to stand in your chair to assert dominance.
Do it. So, and it was like a matter of almost like throwing down the gauntlet. Like if you offered somebody a gambit, if they declined it, they
were
less of a man.
Oh, yeah,
you were a wuss.
Exactly.
Right? So if it came down to it, you found the line like D4, D5, C4. If you didn't play DC.
DXC.
DXC. Exactly.
Yeah.
If D didn't take C, you were an absolute pussy.
Yep.
You couldn't look yourself in the mirror, right?
Nope.
So when somebody finally decided to play E6, there was a collective gasp. Like, he didn't take the pawn. He must be an absolute wuss. What is he doing?
Turned down a duel.
Right? But then it turns out Wilhelm Steinitz was actually more right than he was wrong, even though, like, you know, back in the day, he still had a lot of developing to do. And like, you know, but in those days, that was the truth of it. You know, you had to accept the gambit. If your opponent offered it, the Queen's Gambit,
exactly,
like, D4, D5,
yep,
C4. So, we actually did some tactical puzzles at the dinner table, which is a lot of fun. I think
clearly we were just the most exciting people in the room.
Yeah,
us staring at each other like doing chess puzzles
lovingly.
Yeah,
it was lovingly.
Right,
like,
even among a bunch of Magic nerds, like we really stuck out. It's just the stars of the show, I would say.
So. That was a lot
that
of pad
thai.
It
was a shitload of pad thai.
It was tasty,
fair.
Too.
It really was.
I am distended.
Yeah, portions were not shy.
Very American. Very American portions. But yeah, tell me more about your chess club that you started.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just happened to randomly run into a librarian at the library who was like, right?
Yeah,
usually that's where they are, but he had
at the construction site.
He had a chess openings book, and he was just like doing stuff by himself, like over the board, like doing
like an MCO or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So he was just kind of doing puzzles on his own, and it was something that, you know, I'm a Magic nerd. I got super into poker for a big part of my life.
Oh, sure,
and
sure.
So, like, games of strategy are certainly interesting to me. So I said, hey, you know, teach me what you know. And it really just kind of grew from there.
Beautiful. There's a lot of crossover, too. And for those who don't know, MCO by Nick DeFermian stands for Modern Chess Openings. And it was before internet stuff and chess engines took over. This was how people kind of stayed up to date on openings theory, which was a huge part of tournament chess.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like, the overlap between chess and Magic in some ways and not in others, because
right.
like you said, one of the frustrating parts is if you are rated lower than your opponent, like if your opponent is better at the game than you, there's almost a 0% chance that you will beat someone who's better than you at chess, whereas like in Magic you always have some variance, like you've got a shot. So like there's
yeah.
pluses and minuses of both kinds of games.
Well, I think the fundamental difference between the two disciplines is that chess is a game of complete information. And
yes.
Magic, like poker, is a game of incomplete information, right?
Exactly.
So chess will reward the player who can calculate more deeply or has a deeper theoretical or positional understanding, whereas in Magic or poker, like, you can make the most thought out, you know, fundamentally sound, tactically
right.
accurate.
8 steps ahead.
Yeah, whatever move you make, it is fundamentally sound and correct. And your opponent is going to top deck something, or
yep.
the river card is just going to fuck you, and that's the game.
That's life.
Baby. That's anytime I would take a bad beat,
yeah.
I would just be like, that's the game.
Yeah. Honestly, like, I never played for, like, life-altering amounts of money, but it was my main source of income for a while, and it teaches you so much about, like, just dealing
yourself.
Life. Yeah, honestly, like, it sounds crazy, but it's like kind of some like Buddhist stuff in a way. Like, you have to control your emotions or you're literally going to lose lots of money.
100%. I would say that the mental game
oh, yeah.
is the most critical part of poker.
Absolutely.
Or Magic or chess. Like
yeah.
you can't go on tilt and expect
Never.
To perform optimally.
No, not at all.
You know, so I think that's a huge takeaway that's kind of laterally transferable to other games, right?
Yeah.
The ability to keep yourself mentally level to avoid tilt of any kind, so that you can objectively make the best decision based on the information you have available to you then, right? So I think that's a fundamental thing that you find at the high level.
Oh yeah.
Where, you know, you see GMs, they'll get their shit pushed in, right? And
Pause.
And the next game, they're totally sober, refreshed, and ready to push the first pawn.
Yeah.
Again, like, it's just that's just the game.
Yeah.
You know?
And so out there in the pre-modern discourse land, there's been some math is dead talk. And it's interesting to try to tie that into what we're talking about. Because, like, to your point, the MCO was like the end-all be-all sort of before chess engines. So
yeah.
computers that are basically made to almost solve the game of chess for people who aren't familiar.
Sure.
It really is interesting because if you are into math or computer science or whatever, like, Magic is an extremely difficult game to, like, model in that way. And so that's something that's cool to me because, like, you do the best you can and you can never, like, provably say, like, oh, I'm ahead, like, you know, 1.7 pawns.
Yeah, like 2 cents a pawns.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. So it really forces you to just evaluate positions in a way that is just, like, unlike any game I've ever played. I really like that.
I agree, and I think, beg your pardon, I think the fact that there are, what, like, 26,000 distinct cards now, something
oh,
obscene,
geez. I'm sure it's
something ridiculous.
More than that, yeah.
I mean, look, dealing with however many, you know, like, there's 52 cards in a deck,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there's 32 pieces on a board, like pieces and pawns. Imagine 26,000 distinct
right.
things that are, you know, assembled in a 75 card configuration, independent of every other configuration. The math gets really big, really fast.
Yeah.
So I think it helps to kind of limit the scale of the problem. So funny enough, world chess champion Mikhail Moiseevich Botvinnik said, for the solving of inexact tasks, it's important to limit the scale of the problem to avoid getting bogged down in it. And only then is there a chance of solving it more exactly. So I think that's incredibly appropriate to, you know, kind of the mental game aspect we're talking about here.
Yeah, and the sort of chess tactics puzzles that we were talking about earlier, like, I guess the closest analog I can come to them is, like, if you play a lot of draft or sealed and you're, like, looking at, like, a how do I attack, how do I block, how if he has this trick, like, what do I do? That's something that I really enjoyed about chess, and, like, I wish there was something like that in Magic. Like, it would be so cool if you could just, like, solve Magic puzzles.
If you could do, like, tactics from Magic, I think there was actually like a situation trainer, was it Arena or MTGO or something like that, where there was, like, a, or maybe it was just an app, I forget exactly, it was years and years ago, where you could, you know, you were presented with situations,
yeah,
and here were the cards in your hand. Here's the cards you knew about, here's the board state, and you had to solve for, you know, either the win or a significant material advantage, right? Or whatever. So I thought that was an interesting kind of analog to chess tactical puzzles. It exists, but I think it's way more involved.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? And while we're sort of on the topic of poker, this is something that other Magic podcasts have touched on a little bit, but I think it would be interesting to talk a little bit more about playing poker and playing poker live, because I think a lot of people's experience with poker is mostly online.
Oh, sure.
Over the years. And I think we haven't talked super in depth about it, but I think we both have a lot of experience playing particularly live poker. And what is your poker journey like?
So started playing 1-2, eventually moved into like 1-3 and 2-5 territory, which, like I said earlier, was terrifying. The first time I played 2-5, I took a picture of my name on the wait list and I have it framed in my house.
I was gonna say that one saved on the camera roll, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, I actually have it framed.
That's incredible, dude. That's so cool.
Well, I loved the game so much. It was very important to me, and important enough to study and get good at, like any other discipline. I wanted to kind of plumb the depths and explore the breadth of the, like, you know, navigate the subtle contours of the game, but also kind of learn how it wanted to play.
Yeah,
you know, especially with respect to my play style, which was initially really nitty. Everyone starts out super nitty.
Yeah,
and then I began to develop a little bit more of an aggressive play style once I had some faith that my decisions and the decision tree would, you know, over time yield something net positive, you know. Like, I knew for a fact, okay, if I have ace king off in the small blind, okay, of course I'm gonna three bet, or if it's an open pot, I'm gonna four bet, and then I have to just do the math,
sure,
right? And then depending on what villain does, if we're heads up, I'm hype, all right. I'm hype. I just hope he doesn't have like a strong pair, but you know, queens versus ace king, you know, classic race
situation, yeah.
But anyway, I'm getting off the topic, but I loved 2-5. I was certainly more comfortable with 1-3 because I certainly was, I had a loss aversion bias, you know, like anybody.
Yeah.
But then once I stopped seeing the chips as money and I just saw them as chips, kind of like in Magic, how I just look at life total as another resource.
Sure. Exactly.
Right? Granted, it's one that ends the game, but still, once I realized, oh, it's just another, you know, resource, you know, you can just draw on it and do what you need to do, to win, right? And whatever winning means, like at the poker table, if you're break even or you're slightly ahead, all well and good. Some people just want to beat the game, they just want to crush,
right,
all well and good. And I think Billy falls into that latter category of Magic players where he just wants to crush, and that's impressive. And you know, that's my man's got that drive.
Yeah,
he wants to dominate and be recognized for his dominant performance, and that's fantastic. Whereas me, man, I'm just happy to be above ground, you know?
I'm telling you.
You know?
But there's a good point that you touched on there about moving up in stakes. So the things that Robert's talking about, 1-3, 2-5, like those are the force bets you have to put in if you're not familiar with poker. And so generally 1-3, $300 is the max buy-in, give or take.
1-3, $3 to $500 typically, and then in $2, $5, the small blind and big blind. It depends on the room, $1,000, $2,000, you know, cap.
So these are like not insignificant stakes. And yeah, one thing I wanted to mention is like nothing will make you feel less worried than just like throwing yourself in. And it's obviously you don't need to spend like thousands of dollars at the poker table, but I wanted to bring that up because like it's applied to other parts of my life. When, like, you have to stare at another human being in the face for thousands of dollars, like, nothing in the world phases me anymore. It's like magic. Are you kidding me? Like, I love playing this game, but, like, if I'm in the, you know, top eight of a PTQ or whatever, like, it's not going to phase me.
It's not going to. You are well-tempered.
Yeah. So
you have been well-conditioned.
Yeah. It's just, like, trying to draw, you know, analogs and lessons from anything you do and, like, bring them to other parts of your life. So, yeah, poker is definitely, like, a huge part of that kind of journey for me.
I think one of the huge takeaways from, you know, poker and chess and magic is that all of these disciplines, and they're practically bottomless, right?
Sure.
Like any other worthwhile, unsolvable
yes.
discipline,
right.
is that the process has to be the focus, not the outcome.
Exactly.
You know, because when you are focused on the outcome, in my experience, this is true in my life at least, you are thinking in kind of black and white, a little bit binary, you know, win, lose, super rigid thinking, right? Whereas if you're in love with the process and you're in the process itself, you kind of exist in that nebulous problem solving gray area
sure.
where you can naturally and in a relaxed way calculate these subtle lines that would otherwise be invisible to someone who was just fixated on the outcome.
Sure.
You know, so just being in love with the process itself and the game itself and just playing, which is how humans learn, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just being in that kind of flow state, so to speak,
yeah.
is,
flow
I think,
is a good word for it.
Yeah, thank you. It's 100% optimal, you know, for a person to kind of really bring out the best play, no matter what game you're playing or what you're doing. I think that focus on process instead of outcome
yeah.
is ideal.
And one way that, going back to our esteemed host Billy, one thing that I've always admired about Billy is like just his dedication to brewing and just like staying on like one idea and just like taking it as far as he can. And like that sort of process thing is something I had good sort of ideas about with poker, but like magic, I was never a brewer. Like that was never the thing that appealed to me.
Right.
And yeah, trying to draw some lessons from other games that I've played. Like I've set it as a challenge to myself. Like specifically this weekend I've played a lot of the Ill-Gotten Gains Storm deck, which is a deck I think is could use some help.
Yeah.
Unban Tendrils, please. And like just set it as a challenge to myself to like just not be solely super focused on like just winning, like just doing like that's
right.
Coming back to the game after like being competitive, it really has given me a new kind of perspective and like a different way of sort of just enjoying the game. So
oh, awesome.
Yeah, that's something I have really enjoyed about just like I played a few rounds earlier today and like, you know, they didn't go very well, but like being focused on the process instead of being like, oh man, like I
lost
or whatever. Yeah.
I lost. And then like
throw this deck away.
Right.
Yeah.
You're like, no, I mean, it wasn't entirely me. It wasn't entirely the deck. It was like, you know, the other person.
Yeah.
It was perhaps my blood sugar was low or the conditions were weird or like there's a million variables. But I think that your approach is, I think it's laudable and it's, you know, for lack of a better way to put it, it's correct. Like you're drawing from other experiences to optimize your presence of mind
yeah.
in the game.
Sure.
You know, it's fantastic.
Yeah. And I think this is something we've touched on this podcast a lot is like, especially Jay's tournament preparation podcast. When I don't know exactly sort of the quote, but it was like, figure out the thing that you want to get out of Magic and not just like, you know, don't say, you know, I'm only going to, like, play for fun and, like, you know, I'm never going to be competitive. Like, if that's something that appeals to you, try it out. But
well,
like
two things can be true at the same time.
Sure, yeah. Exactly. And, like, as long as you're honest about, like, what your intentions and, like, goals are, like, that's just going to make your enjoyment, like, way more likely than, you know, if you just kind of show up to a tournament without doing a lot of practice or whatever and try to be super competitive. It's like you have to devote the time, but if you're someone who just like enjoys playing the game for fun, like that's totally
just
cool.
Just say
too.
It, man. Like yeah. you can lie to me, just don't lie to yourself.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Cool.
Awesome.
So, Rob, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I will give the floor back to our esteemed host, Billy.
Well, the pleasure was mine. Thank you. All right.
Later.
Cool. So that all turned into sports therapy time with Rob. Sorry for the hard cut, but it was just who was in the room at the time. I hope you all enjoyed meeting him. I quite admire him. And you can expect another EW update in the coming days. Thanks for listening. This has been Billy from the Duress Crew from Pittsburgh during Internal Weekend. Bye. See you tomorrow.